This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, sourcing, selecting, and blending teas since 1966. 800-999-2132 or on the web at peets.com. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's FIFA Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Fiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a genetically modified grass is generating concern over reportedly spreading from a test site into nearby wild areas. The Bush administration is proposing amendments to the War Crimes Act that would protect policymakers who authorize the humiliation of detainees. And the United Nations top official warned today the Darfur situation is becoming catastrophic.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,591 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 44,596 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website informationclearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 10th, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
Good evening, I'm Marlise Franklin. State Senator Ben Westland said today he'll forego a run for the Oregon governor's post. Westland told a press conference in Salem he will step aside because he did not want to become a spoiler who took votes from Governor Ted Kulongoski. Kulongoski, a Democrat, will face Portland Republican Ron Saxton in the November election. Political experts were split as to which candidate Westland, who served as a Republican in the state Senate before becoming an independent, would have affected most. His campaign announced in July that he had logged enough signatures to garner an independent spot on the ballot. Westland had even collected an endorsement from the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Westland had cast himself as a fiscal reform candidate, pushing changes in Oregon's tax structure to alleviate the state's reliance on individual income taxes to stock its general fund. Yet he is also a proponent of using alternative energy sources and maintains that preventative and primary health care is a fundamental right.
With coffee in hand, travelers went through security checkpoints this morning at Portland International Airport as officials scrambled to enforce a new restriction on liquids carried aboard jetliners. Airline personnel and signs at check-in points told passengers that liquids would be barred from carry-on luggage as a result of a terrorist plot to blow up planes leaving Britain for the United States. A spokesperson for the Port of Portland, which operates the airport, said the morning rush at the airport went smoothly and that the lines had been short. He said there have been no flight cancellations from Portland, and he was unaware of any flight delays resulting from the new security procedures. The spokesperson added that there were no additional security restrictions. The real focus, he said, was about the ban on carry-on liquids.
The head of the Oregon-based humanitarian aid group Mercy Corps says without a ceasefire and access for aid groups, a humanitarian disaster is just a week away. KBOO's Mike Monkbold reports.
A humanitarian crisis of epic proportions is just a week away in Lebanon, according to Oregon relief workers. Mercy Corps' CEO, Neil Kenny Geyer, just returned to Oregon from Beirut. He says the entire humanitarian community is struggling to get supplies into Lebanon, and some hospitals say they'll have to shut down within a week if they aren't resupplied.
There are fuel shortages, there are shortages of food and medicines, and there are shortages of power.
Kenny Geyer says that between a quarter and a third of the country has been forced to leave their homes.
I visited a school that had been built for 1,000 students, and you had 10,000 people living in and around the school.
Kenny Geyer says with an estimated 1 million people displaced by the violence, Mercy Corps is urging a ceasefire in the region and immediate access for AIDS groups. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Mike Monkvold, KBOO News.
Del Monte Fresh Foods has reached a $400,000 settlement with 8 former employees who claimed they were fired for complaining about safety problems. Though it denies wrongdoing, Del Monte will pay $5,000 to each of 8 fired workers and will deposit more than $300,000 into a settlement fund for class action claims. The case originated from a dispute which was reported to a staffing agency placing workers at Del Monte about a work shift which also included concerns about safety issues. The employees claimed that once they voiced those concerns, they were fired. The fired workers filed complaints with the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, alleging the agency violated state law by firing them for complaining about safety problems.
A leaky blood-brain barrier that allows crucial antioxidants to spill out of fluid in the brain may contribute to the development of Alzheimer's disease, researchers said this week. That finding and intriguing evidence of a link between the debilitating brain disease and a loss of vitamin C were released at the annual meeting of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians right here in Portland. The team studied 36 people with mid to moderate Alzheimer's disease. Researchers found that 22% of their subjects had high levels of a chemical indicating blood-brain barrier disruption, and that higher levels of vitamin C also found were associated with lower levels of shrinkage in the hippocampus, the seat of memory, and the brain's temporal lobes.
The participants were probably not the first people you would think about as advocates for political correctness. And while it does occasionally happen, a meeting of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission is probably not the first place that comes to mind for a debate about semantics to break out. Both happened last Friday during a discussion about issuing free hunting tags, 10 for deer, 10 for elk, and 5 for antelope, to terminally ill youths. Danny Benson, the Oregon ambassador for the nonprofit Hunt for a Lifetime, asked that the eligibility requirement for the tags be changed to youths with life-threatening illnesses. All of the commissioners agreed that a change was appropriate. The insurmountable hurdle is the language in the 2005 authorizing legislation, Senate Bill 694, which includes the words terminally ill. On Cook's advice, commissioners are leaving it up to the youth's doctors to parse the definitions of terminal versus life-threatening illnesses and make the call on recommending patients to receive the hunting tags.
Parts of the seafloor off Oregon are carpeted with dead Dungeness crabs and rotting sea worms, according to Oregon State University scientists who have discovered a large dead zone off the Oregon coast. KBOO reporter Miriam Widman has more.
The OSU scientists say it's the worst low oxygen conditions ever observed on the west coast of the United States. OSU marine ecologist Francis Chan says it was pretty bad.
All we saw were just piles of dead crabs on the floor.
Chan says the low oxygen isn't just affecting crabs and rockfish.
We also know that it moves fish around because fish that can get out of the way will just swim away from this dead zone, but they also put themselves in some strange habitat like tide pools. So you'll get wolf eels in tide pools. So really odd changes in where fishes are found.
Chan and others say they can't conclusively say global warming is at fault, but they do note that the low oxygen levels are due to changes in the wind pattern, and global warming may be behind that.
So even if this event is not the direct consequences of global warming, I think it's more accurate that what we can say is that this gives us a glimpse as to what's possible when we change, when we make some simple changes to the wind pattern along the Oregon coast.
And it's pretty big, Chan says.
North to south, it's between Florence, at least between Florence and Cascade Head, so up by Lincoln City, so about 70 miles. And to be honest, it's been as shallow, as close to shore as we've been able to get to with our research vessel.
And that's pretty close to shore, he says. Chan says the dead zone shouldn't affect fishermen, In fact, it might help them, since fish are avoiding the low oxygen area.
So depending on where you go, you can either have a really good fishing day or probably a very good fishing day.
For now, OSU is simply in a monitoring mode. Scientists say the zone is so big that there's nothing they can do, other than tell the public, if you're seeing dead crabs and fish along the coast, it's because of low oxygen, and not likely to be because of pollution or any harmful algae blooms. I'm Miriam Widman, KBOO News.
An unapproved genetically modified grass called creeping bent grass has spread up to 3 miles outside a test site in Oregon, with 9 different plants being identified. The GMO product was modified to make it impervious to an herbicide and was designed to appeal to golf course managers who would be able to spray large areas to kill off weeds without damaging the grass. Homeowners were considered another lucrative market because it could help them to create perfect lawns in front of their houses. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has ordered a full environmental audit of its impact and spread to determine the threat to wildlife. Unlike GM crops such as maize and soybeans, which are annuals and unable to reproduce, this perennial grass was able to produce seeds during outdoor tests.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission has banned the age-old practice of hook-and-line riggings to grab crayfish in Oregon, and in order to close a loophole that a handful of Oregonians have used to fish in streams close to trout, salmon, or steelhead fishing. Under the old rules, anglers using conventional fishing gear with hooks and bait in a closed stream could argue that they were angling for crayfish and not subject to conventional fishing bans. The new rule will thwart this approach. Beginning January 1st, crayfish harvesters can still legally use fishing rods with baited lines, but they cannot use a hook to hold the bait. The crayfish rule was the only statewide change to the 2007 sport fishing regulations, which were adopted last week by the commission. There were no significant changes to any angling regulation in southwest Oregon or the marine region.
L.L. Stubbs Stewart Memorial State Park promises to be a paradise for campers, hikers, bicyclists, and equestrians, but officials say the park won't be ready to open until Memorial Day weekend 2007. The park will offer over 1,600 acres of access to forests and canyons and is located about 4 miles north of U.S. 26. It will be the first full-service state campground in Washington County and the first to open statewide since 1972. The full plan for the park, much of which will be built before May, calls for over 100 camping sites.
A late-night adopt-a-thon at the Southern Oregon Humane Society will offer a second chance for strays that have run out of time at regional shelters and for tough-to-place canines at the Table Rock Road facility. Coordinators for Friday's Hot August Night are spending the week gathering unwanted animals from facilities that are out of space or unable to offer a no-kill policy like the Humane Society's. The Humane Society will stay open until 10 p.m. with all necessary staff and paperwork on hand in order to complete the adoption process. The facility is located at 2910 Table Rock Road.
Nearly $50,000 worth of pricey metal trash cans were ripped from their bolts and stolen from Oakland, California streets. More than 60 trash cans were uprooted and trucked away from various locations in recent months. Some residents say they tripped over exposed screws in the sidewalk where the cans were once bolted down. Others say they spotted a white pickup truck hauling the cans away. Leading city officials believe they were being sold as scrap.
The current time is 5:15, 5:16. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, Vice President Dick Cheney has criticized Lamont's victory as an indication the Democrats are soft on national security. And Australian scientists have made one of the greatest breast cancer breakthrough studies in years. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Vancouver, Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.
foiled plot at Heathrow has caused concerns on the other side of the Atlantic as well. FSRN's Selena Masuda reports on the reaction in D.C.
If you're planning to fly, be at the airport earlier than usual and don't carry on board any beverages and other liquids like hair gels, toothpaste, and lotions. Starting Thursday, the Transportation Security Administration adopted extra security measures. The move is in response to the arrest of 21 people in the UK. They're allegedly involved in plotting to blow up in mid-flight planes heading from the UK to the US. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff announced that the plot involved a liquid chemical device. There will be other security measures implemented, says Chertoff.
United States Customs and Border Protection will be increasing enforcement efforts in the international arrival areas, including the use of advanced targeting tools, special response teams, including baggage and aircraft search teams, baggage X-ray equipment, specially trained canine units, and explosive detection technology. These measures, again, will be constantly evaluated and updated as circumstances warrant.
Exceptions to the no liquid rule include baby formula, breast milk, or juice if a baby or small child is traveling. Also, prescription medicine with a name that matches the passenger's ticket, and insulin and essential other non-prescription medicines will be allowed. No arrests have been made in the United States, and no evidence points to a bombing plan organized in the United States. Two U.S. counterterrorism officials told the Associated Press that United, American, and Continental Airlines were targets. British airport officials are allowing very little to be carried onto any British aircraft. Flights to Heathrow have been suspended, and other British flights are facing severe delays. New security measures are being implemented by both Britain and the U.S. Britain raised their threat level to critical. The U.S. issued a code red for commercial flights between the U.K. and U.S. Furthermore, the Department of Homeland Security elevated the country to a code yellow. While on vacation, Bush issued a statement calling the threat of terrorism real and that necessary steps must be taken to counteract al-Qaeda-like terrorism.
This nation is at war with Islamic fascists who will use any means to destroy those of us who love freedom.
Bush's declaration of war on Islamic fascists worries people like Mahdi Bray, executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation. Bray's organization is coordinating marches this Saturday throughout the country to protest Israel's military actions against Palestine and Lebanon, as well as U.S. involvement in the conflicts. Bray warns that the Bush administration will use the bombing plot for political gain and to divert attention from criticism that the Bush administration faces because of their involvement in the Middle East.
This is an administration that has used the fear factor for political gain, especially around the area of terrorism. Karl Rove made it very, very clear to Republican candidates when they were running for office that this is something that they can run on. The fear of terrorism, you know, versus presentation of being strong in national security. So these are the things that I think that the administration has used for political advantage and opportunism, and I don't think they've stopped this behavior.
The anti-war march is also being organized by ANSWER and the National Council on Arab Americans. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Selena Masuta.
The Bush administration drafted amendments to the War Crimes Act that would retroactively protect policymakers from possible criminal charges for authorizing any humiliating and degrading treatment of detainees. According to lawyers who have seen the proposal, the move by the administration is in the latest effort to deal with treatment of those taken into custody in the war on terror. At issue are interrogations carried out by the CIA and the degree to which harsh tactics such as waterboarding were authorized by administration officials. One section of the draft would outlaw torture and inhuman or cruel treatment. It does not contain prohibitions from Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions against outrages upon personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatment. Another section would apply the legislation retroactively, according to two lawyers who have seen the contents of the section.
Conservationists say they're not satisfied with new timber rules aimed at protecting the northern spotted owl. The State Forest Practices Board made a pair of logging rules permanent today. They're meant to help the owl's sliding population and were previously in effect as emergency measures. One measure stops certain owl-protecting buffer zones from being logged. The second rule prevents landowners from counting previously logged land as owl habitat. But Peter Goldman with the Washington Forest Law Center says that's not enough. And an attorney representing a pair of Audubon Society chapters that are threatening to sue the state over spotted owl protection says it isn't enough. Public Lands Commissioner Doug Sutherland disagrees. He says the new rules show Washington's leadership while federal officials develop an owl recovery plan.
Vice President Dick Cheney has continued the Bush administration's push to characterize the primary loss of Senator Joe Lieberman as an indication that the Democratic Party is weakening on security issues. Cheney claims that Lieberman had been, quote, pushed aside because of his willingness to support an aggressive posture, unquote, on terror. When reporters pressed Cheney on the point that Lieberman was just one of three incumbents to lose primary elections on Tuesday, the vice president outright rejected the notion that there was any anti-incumbent sentiment at work. Cheney went so far as to interrupt one reporter with a one-word answer, no, before repeating the same answer when the reporter finished the question.
Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid says he expects the Democrat who knocked off Senator Joe Lieberman in Connecticut's primary to win in November, and he remains convinced his party will gain at least five Senate seats in the fall elections. The Nevada Democrat threw his support today behind Ned Lamont, who defeated Lieberman last night in their Democratic primary. Reid says Lamont is the person to beat now. He says he will not try to persuade Lieberman to drop plans to run as an independent. He says it's not up to him to judge what Lieberman should do. Reid says there was a perception in Connecticut that Lieberman was too close to President Bush. He says in many respects that race is a referendum on Bush more than anything else.
For the first time, a woman has been chosen as one of two candidates facing off for the presidency of the Navajo Nation, whose reservation is the largest in the country, with unofficial results in from all but one of the tribe's 110 chapters. Current President Joe Shirley Jr. had finished with 28%, followed by challenger Linda Lovejoy with 22%, putting the two into a runoff election. The results still have to be certified by tribal elections officials, which will be expected within 30 days. The top two finishers will face each other in the general election. Economic development is expected to be one of the top issues in the election as the tribe addresses poverty and unemployment. Turnout was nearly 48% among the almost 97,000 Navajo eligible to vote.
Police in Maryland have busted four women who allegedly posted prostitution ads on the San Francisco-based Craigslist.org. Authorities arrested the women at hotels near the Baltimore airport. They've been charged with illegally soliciting sex. Police say the women allegedly arranged several weeks' worth of appointments in advance, then flew into a city to meet with clients.
The current time is 5:25, and now it's time for our daily commentary by Jim Hightower.
Isn't it great to know that our Homeland Security officials are on the job to protect you and me? Yes, sirree. They're out there on our borders right now, protecting us from getting cheaper drug prices from Canada. It received practically no publicity, but last November, a Homeland tentacle called the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency quietly began confiscating mailings of prescription drugs that senior citizens and others in our country had ordered from pharmacies in Canada. Are these dangerous drugs? Not at all. They're the same medicines that doctors here prescribe, but they cost only half as much or less. That's because the U.S. is practically the only country in the whole world that doesn't stop the drug giants from price gouging. So shopping for the exact same medicines outside the U.S. is a way for consumers to avoid being ripped off. But George W.'s Border Protection Police are now stepping in to, well, to protect the rip-off prices of the drug giants, which get the bulk of their global profits by gouging American consumers. Perhaps you thought that our Homeland Security Agency was focused on assuring, you know, our security. But no, it's busy defending our borders against fairly priced drugs being delivered to heart patients, diabetes sufferers, and others. The good news is that the public has rebelled, forcing both the House and Senate to pass an amendment prohibiting border agents from seizing medicines imported from Canada. However, the bad news is that the drug corporations are major GOP campaign donors and employ more Washington lobbyists than there are members of Congress. So, the Bush White House and Republican congressional leaders are gathering behind closed doors to kill this pro-consumer amendment, even though it has already passed in both houses of Congress. This is Jim Hightower saying, to make your voice heard in this fight, contact Americans for Health Care, 866-428-6837.
This Jim Hightower Common Sense Commentary is brought to you by the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation. To learn more, visit www.joinmpp.org or call toll-free 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Stay tuned for more great programming following our newscast. At 6, Voices of the Middle East with Gudar Zegdadari. At 7, Good Times with Reggae Bob. Weather-wise, the sun is trying its best in the Hood River Valley this week with highs in the 70s and 80s with intermittent clouds. And in the Columbia River Gorge, the sun's trying to stay away behind heavy clouds with highs in the mid-70s. You're listening to the KBU Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Israeli soldiers today consolidated strategic positions in southern Lebanon and warned of new attacks on Beirut and the north of the country. FSRN's Lebanese correspondent reports from the northern city of Tripoli.
At around noon today, Israeli army airplanes dropped leaflets in a town just south of Tripoli to warn people it would strike any vehicle bigger than a car traveling all along the road. This means the only coastal road spared by the Israeli army aircraft promises to be free of any vehicles from this evening until tomorrow morning, further strangling the country already suffering from a ground, air and sea embargo for nearly 1 month. If the Sunni population of the northern city of Tripoli was quite indifferent to the war sparkled in the south, they are now seriously worrying about a possible extension of the conflict into their region. Today's cafe conversation were all focused on the Hezbollah's leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's speech yesterday, in which he promised to turn their precious land of the south into a graveyard for occupying Zionists. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Khalid Simohan in Troublos, in Tripoli, Lebanon.
British airports remain on critical alert after police foiled an alleged terror ring suspect of plotting to blow up a number of aircraft bound for the U.S. FSRN's Helen Kelly reports from London.
Homes and businesses across England are being searched and 21 people questioned tonight after an alleged terror plot to blow up British planes in mid-air was disrupted. It is thought the group planned to detonate liquid explosive devices smuggled in hand luggage in a series of simultaneous attacks. As many as 10 planes were thought to be targeted, including 3 US aircraft. The suspects were rounded up in pre-dawn raids in London, High Wycombe, Buckinghamshire and Birmingham after a covert investigation that included US security authorities. British Home Secretary John Reid:
the police, acting with the security service MI5, are investigating an alleged plot to bring down a number of aircraft through mid-flight explosions, causing a considerable loss of life.
Home Secretary Reid said police were confident the main players have now been accounted for, but would remain on high alert for the immediate future.
We are involved in a long, wide and deep struggle against very evil people. This is not a case of one civilization against another, one religion against another.
It is believed the overnight arrests were made not because an attack was likely to happen today, but for other intelligence reasons, which meant quick action was needed. All inbound flights to Heathrow and all short-haul flights to and from the UK airports remain cancelled this evening. Helen Kelly, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations top humanitarian official warned today that the situation in Sudan's war-ravaged Darfur region was becoming dramatically more dangerous as rapes and attacks by militias and rebel factions continue, despite a three-month-old peace deal. The UN said a day earlier that the May 5th peace deal signed between Sudan's government and Darfur's main rebel group was doomed to failure unless the government provided more support. More than 200,000 have been killed in the region since 2003 when ethnic African tribes revolted against the Arab-led Khartoum government.
More than 400 young women have been raped and murdered in northern Mexico since 1993. Their bodies left in the desert's border region just south of El Paso, Texas. This summer, the Mexican government returned 14 cases it has been investigating back to the state of Chihuahua. According to officials, there is no evidence to substantiate a federal crime. As FSRN's Leslie Clark reports, the families of the murdered and missing women in Ciudad Juarez are infuriated as they face yet another setback in their mission for justice.
Cipriano Jurado works with 25 families of victims in Juarez, Chihuahua. Jurado is with the Centro de Investigación y Solidaridad Obrera, or CISO. She says the families understand that the Mexican government's decision will further delay answers about the murder and disappearance of their loved ones.
The families are angry and frustrated. They feel that there's been a lot of time lost in investigating the crimes against their daughters. And now the government is returning the cases to the Chihuahua Attorney General.
With the federal government's position that resolving the femicides is a matter for the state of Chihuahua, the onus is on the state's Attorney General. CISO is prepared to monitor the AG's investigations.
Well, with the new Attorney General, there have been some advances in some cases. The problem is, in other cases, there hasn't been any advancement. What we are doing is demanding a serious investigation.
Overall, Amnesty International reports very little progress by state authorities, according to spokesman Eric Olson.
The state and local authorities have so utterly failed in their obligations. The levels of corruption, ineptitude, and criminal negligence are so evident that we have said the federal government has a moral and a legal responsibility to intervene and assist in and participate in the investigation and prosecution of these cases.
While the investigations stall, the killings are escalating. In only the first 5 months of this year, 23 murders have already been reported. That's approximately the same number of murders committed in all of 2004. There is some optimism that recent resolutions approved by the U.S. Congress will motivate Mexican authorities to bring an end to the murders. This spring, the U.S. House and Senate approved identical resolutions urging U.S. involvement in solving the Juarez femicides. Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico authored the Senate resolution.
The resolution does raise the visibility of this issue, does bring it to the attention of the Mexican government as well as our own government, that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. That was the purpose of it, was to be sure that it not be dropping off the agenda when the two countries talk to each other.
Advocates for the murdered women and their families are now turning their attention to the new Mexican administration's involvement in resolving the murders. Olson says it appears to him the outgoing government is washing its hands of a very serious and tragic series of events.
It does appear to me that the Fox administration is sort of tying up loose ends, dismissing cases, closing down the office of the special prosecutor, kind of in a way to be able to present a blank slate to the incoming government.
But Jurado isn't counting on the government to resolve the femicides.
What is important is not so much having faith in the authorities, but faith in the organizations working for justice for our young women.
Ultimately, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights finds justice for the murdered women in Juarez and the resolution of the killings requires attention to the root causes of violence against women. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Political instability continues to reign in Mexico as the Federal Electoral Tribunal carries on its partial recount of presidential votes. In Oaxaca, the climate of violence has left three people dead. Armed attacks on the office of the biggest selling newspaper, and the arrest of social leaders all in less than 48 hours. Yet as FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports, despite the repression, a massive social movement continues to hold protests demanding the immediate resignation of the state's governor.
A broad citizens' movement in Oaxaca has been demanding the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz for more than 2 months, saying the state government is authoritarian and corrupt. The movement to oust the governor has made up of a cross-section of Oaxacan society and gained momentum when the government launched a crackdown on thousands of striking public school teachers. Civil society organizations, teachers, farmers, activists, indigenous groups, and individual citizens have formed the so-called Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, or APO in Spanish, to serve as an alternative government structure. Members of the APO have taken over and blockaded every significant state government building in the state capital. On August 1st, thousands of women affiliated with the APO took over the state-run television and radio station. After marching through the city center, banging on pots and pans, the women's demonstration took a spontaneous turn. Anna, a woman who participated in the takeover, explains her reasons for occupying the state-run TV station.
These offices, which have as their slogan the Channel of Oaxacans, were lying, because it was the channel of the PRI-run government. The information wasn't true. They were lying. So this produced a frustration within the populace, as if they were even being made fun of, which is when we women decided to take over the station. It wasn't planned at first, but the general discontent is that people were already fed up. We decided in that moment to come here.
The women continue to occupy the TV and radio station. They broadcast independently produced videos and anti-government programming. Many of the women are nervous that authorities will launch a violent operation to take back the studios. The women interviewed for this report only identified themselves by their first name or asked not to be named. Although the occupation of the airways could be considered federal crimes, many women are contributing work, money, or food to the protesters there. This elderly woman came from a outlying community with her daughter to serve hot coffee to people at the station.
Toda la gente que vienen lejos están dando cuenta.
All of the outsiders who come here are realizing what is happening here in Oaxaca. That's why we're here now, rain or shine, to show that we are supporting Oaxaca.
The conflict in Oaxaca has reached the proportion of a popular rebellion due to the refusal of governor to resign and the lack of intervention from the federal government. Gisela, a middle school teacher who is also a member of the APO, says that even though the federal and state government are from different political parties, the federal government does not see a benefit to intervening in the crisis.
Pues simplemente porque es el mismo sistema, y no es posible para ellos que el pueblo levante la voz.
Simply because it is the same system. For them, it's not possible for the people to rise up and impose their own will. We know that at the national level, there was an electoral fraud. At the national level, there's a situation that is preventing the government from maintaining control in many places, but especially in Oaxaca. Now there are protest encampments in Mexico City, too. There are many things. The country is really a disaster. They can't control it. So the fact that in one state the people have risen up to overthrow a governor, for them, it's no good. Because where does that leave their authority?
The situation in Oaxaca shows no signs of letting up, and spontaneous protests have become a regular occurrence. For FSRM, Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca.
Nigeria's House of Representatives has issued a report slamming Chevron for tax evasion. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The American energy giant has been asked to pay $492 million in back taxes to the Nigerian government. The report released early this week by Nigeria's lower house of Congress is the result of a broad investigation into allegations of tax evasion, fraud and corruption made against Chevron. The report says the company inflated its tax returns to the government and overstated the cost of its operation in order to evade taxes. The House must still debate and adopt measures before recommendations made in the report could come into effect. Chevron has in the meantime denied that it evaded tax. The company said it was reviewing the report and will soon issue its official position on the matter. Multinational companies operating in Nigeria have in the past been accused of shortchanging the country of tens of millions of dollars through tax evasion. Only last year, the U.S. company Halliburton was found to have made illicit payments to Nigerian tax officials to enable it secure favorable tax cuts. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Nepal's government and the Maoists both say they are striving for peace. As FSRN's PC Dubey reports, the contradictions displayed on both sides have the potential to jeopardize all prospects for peace.
The Maoist remark triggered panic among masses. Nepal's global image had already nosedived with the failure of the UN team to persuade the government and Maoists to reach consensus over the disarmament of Maoist guerrillas. Maoists refused to disarm unless the Nepal army disarmed too. However, yesterday both the government and Maoists tried to salvage the peace process. They turned to the UN for help. Ironically, the two sides sent their own letters, but they said the same thing. Analysts fear Nepal's Koirala has succumbed to the Maoist pressures and agreed that Maoists would not disarm. The letter said that their arms will remain under the UN-appointed civilian monitors until the voters go to the polls to draft a new constitution. Pramod Bihari Singh is a social activist heading Indo-Nepal Friendship Association, INFA, engaged in institutionalization of democracy in Nepal. He believes yesterday's face-saving step to revitalize the ongoing peace dialogue is a farce.
Again, there is talk that Maoists should relinquish arms, but in no case would they give up arms. It is simply an imagination. Political parties don't have the guts to make them relinquish arms. The situation is getting bleaker. We are again inching towards civil war, which would be much more disastrous than the past one.
Ashok Kumar, a media analyst specializing in Maoist issue, disagrees. He does not rule out a second spell of Maoist violence. Maoists want to fight for more rights.
Maoists are aware the collapse of peace dialogue won't be favorable for them too. But their gripe is that they fought for a decade and joined the battle for democracy and yet gained nothing. So they feel betrayed.
Singh, however, affirms democracy would not have been restored if US and India had not pressured the king. Singh believes Maoist participation would be destructive for the democracy.
If Maoists joined the government, then there would be the government of Maoists alone. Political parties would perish. Maoists are an organization of anarchy. They would only breed troubles for common people.
But Kumar feels the ousting of Maoists from power would not benefit the country. Neither political parties, the army, nor the king trust each other. So the chance to marginalize the Maoist is bleak. Thus, a civil war could evolve with foreign intervention. But a puppet regime in saddle could breed new sorts of political and economic crisis. Kumar strongly prescribes integration of Maoists in the country's polity. From Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
Israel continued its attacks by firing missiles into Gaza today, as UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said that the events in Lebanon should not sidetrack the crisis in the occupied territories. Annan added that the killing of Gaza civilians was unjustifiable. FSRN's Palestinian correspondent Rami Al-Magari reports from Rafah, Israel.
Israeli army on August 2nd invaded the Shoka village east of Rafah city. 17 people were killed, including children. 50 others were wounded, including children. In addition, the village infrastructure suffered a great deal of destruction. The Shoka is inhabited by 14,000 Palestinian residents. The majority are closely connected, mainly as relatives. Mayor of the village, Mansour Breka.
This is a rural area where families are bound by tribal connections. No strangers can enter at nighttime. Therefore, we are refuting the Israeli side's allegations that the area is used for launching rockets. The farmers here are taking care to their living earnings as they prevent any moves, whether by the resistance forces or the thieves or alike.
FSRN asked Mayor Mansour about the amount of destruction.
700 dunams, or 700 square kilometers, of greenhouses have been destroyed completely. 58 houses have also been completely devastated in the first stage, as children, women, and the ailing have been evacuated to safe shelters at the UNRWA local schools. More than 175 pottery and livestock houses have also been damaged. The whole infrastructure has been totally destroyed.
26-year-old local farmer Tawfiq Al-Barakat described what he has lost in the August 2nd attack.
As for the destruction I have been inflicted, 2 dunams of greenhouses plus 4 other dunams of electronically irrigated farm of garlic plus 9 sheep and 2,000 bricks destroyed by the tanks, as well as a barbed wire fence around my land.
72 Palestinians of those wounded during the Israeli raids on Gaza have had their limbs cut. This has raised doubts by the Palestinian side about possible use of illegal weapons. Khaled Radi, spokesman of the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We absolutely speculate that what has been used against our people are weapons containing acid, chemical, sulfuric, shrapnel, and flesh-shedded substances that have left some horrible features on the dead and wounded.
Gracila Lopez, acting head of the sub-delegation at the International Committee of the Red Cross, is aware of the accusations about the use of illegal weapons, but is unable to confirm this.
We are in contact with hospitals and, of course, with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society working in the medical field, and it is of our concern to follow up on these allegations of the use of new types of weapons. At this moment, we cannot confirm the use of any particular type of new weapon. We are not in a position to do so or to monitor the type of weapon being used, but we are following the situation and take these allegations seriously.
The International Red Cross and the UN are investigating the use of illegal weapons. For FSRN, this is Rami Al-Migari reporting from Gaza.
Heavy fighting broke out today between the Sri Lankan government forces and the Tamil Tiger rebels over a key irrigation reservoir in the eastern part of the island. Just 2 days ago, both sides claimed credit for ending the three-week blockade of water supplies to thousands of acres of paddy fields. FSRN's Sri Lankan correspondent reports.
The truce monitors termed the ongoing escalation of hostilities in Sri Lanka as a low-intensity war which has resulted in severe casualties on both the combatants and the civilians. The government said today the rebels first fired artillery on the troops to regain control of Mavilaru Dam that the forces claim is under their control. But the Tamil Tigers say that the troops started an offensive in two fronts today to take control of Mavilaru, which is in their control. Government said 5 soldiers were killed and 41 injured by the mortar and artillery fire from the rebels. A rebel spokesman said they lost 10 fighters and another 20 were wounded in today's fighting. Rebels say 50 civilians have been killed and another 200 were wounded and thousands have been forced to flee their homes. David Vinati is the communication coordinator of the International Committee of Red Cross.
We have been informed that there are many displaced moving to the south. We don't know the number because we couldn't reach the area. We don't know the situation really. We don't know in which condition they are working.
The government denied the charges. It said the troops were targeting the rebels' artillery positions and doesn't know about the displacement of civilians. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponneya Manikavasagam in Bounia, Sri Lanka.
High school students in Chile are growing restless again just months after massive mobilizations demanding reforms to the country's education system. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago.
High school students are meeting today with the new Minister of Education to let her know of their dissatisfaction with the slow pace of resolving their demands. The Presidential Education Commission was formed after the students carried out intense street demonstrations in April and May. The commission is expected to hand the government a reforms package that can be later be sent to Congress to legislate changes to the Education Act. Students want a reform to the Education Act that puts an end to the educational system as a for-profit institution and to transform it into a truly public system. On Tuesday, high school students took to the streets of Santiago, demanding that authorities respond to their demands promptly. But the demonstration turned violent when the students began pelting the district's educational offices with rocks. Students had fought police, who made some 160 arrests. The new education minister is telling the students they must be patient, saying reforms to the system do not happen in 2 or 3 months. The Students' Assembly will meet tomorrow to determine their future actions. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Nearly 100 pounds of dangerous weapons-grade uranium has been covertly removed from a research reactor in Poland by U.S. authorities. The U.S. National Nuclear Security Agency became aware of the cache at a civilian institute about 20 miles from Warsaw, and officials worked quietly for several months to plan its retrieval and disposal in Russia, the Boston Globe reported. It was picked up under heavy guard and taken to an undisclosed site in Russia as part of the U.S.-Russia Global Threat Reduction Initiative, established in 2004. The United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency played a role in securing the enriched uranium, which will be downblended into a safer form, according to an anonymous source.
Australian scientists have helped unearth the biggest breast cancer breakthrough in years. The first discovery of common genes linked to the disease. An unpublished large-scale international study has made findings connecting two genes with a 10% increased risk of breast cancer. The breakthrough is being heralded as the biggest in the field of breast cancer genetics since the discovery of two high-risk genes in the 1990s. Researchers studied 9 genes believed to have links to the disease and tested the claims on 40,000 women from Australia, Europe, and the U.S., half who had breast cancer. Results showed that 2 were clearly linked to the increased risk. The chance of women with these common genes developing the cancer was only 10%, compared with 60% for the far rarer genes. Once scientists have discovered a dozen more of these common genes associated with the disease, women carrying several of them could be at significant risk and tested accordingly.
Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu has spoken of the miracle of giving sight to people through cataract operations. Speaking at the launch of a drive to perform 100,000 cataract operations worldwide over the next 100 days, he said sighted people took so many things for granted. The drive was launched by an international NGO, the Christian Blind Mission, at a hospital in Cape Town on Tuesday. According to CBM President Professor Alan Foster, about 17 million people worldwide are totally blind because of cataracts. It is a reversible condition in a relatively simple 10 to 15 minute operation. Over the past 30 years, he said, CBM has provided funding for over 6 million cataract operations and last year was responsible for 640,000. The 100,000 Miracles in 100 Days campaign would mean that number of extra operations would be carried out this year. South Africa has been chosen as the venue for the launch because of the symbolism of the fact that there are about 100,000 people in the country who are blinded by cataracts. About 2,000 of the miracle operations will be carried out in South Africa.
It all started when Edgar the Gnome left his home under the water fountain. For a few years, the garden gnome had been content to watching over Missouri residents Don and Karen Walker's front lawn. However, one lonely spring night, the dwarf with the red cap and knee-length beard disappeared. For 2 months, Edgar remained gnome-napped. until last Sunday when a stranger came out of the darkness and returned him to the walker's front porch. Resting against Edgar Brown's boots was a gift. Edgar the Gnome had taken a tour out west, traveling through 7 states, including Arizona, before returning to his home. Edgar the Gnome has remained stonily quiet about his summer adventure. He seems content to let the pictures do the talking. He visited some of the regular tourist hot spots, including Area 51 in Roswell, New Mexico, and the Four Corners. Edgar also seemed fascinated by the unusual. He shared a moment with the world's largest prairie dog in Colby, Kansas, and visited what appears to be a buffalo ranch. In another photo, he seems to have lost a little innocence. Edgar posed underneath a sign for the Boom Boom Cabaret. So what made Edgar leave his garden home? Maybe a mischievous fairy whispered the idea in his ear. Where will it go next? Nome, Alaska?
That's the Cable Evening News for Thursday, August 10th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kabu.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kabu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Denise Kowalczyk. Our wire editors are Ross Egan, Mike Munkfold, and Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editors are Rochelle Koivunen, Rochelle, and Josh Johnson. Special thanks to reporters Miriam Widman and Mike Munkfold. Our engineer is Josh Johnson, and our executive producer is Noah Eaton. I'm Marlise Franklin. I can get that name right. Thanks for joining us.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, hear a talk by Selma James, renowned feminist activist, author, and critical thinker. She was a coordinator of the Global Women's Strike, where she spoke in Portland in June. At 10, local activist Yvonne Simmons and artist Rachel Carey Harper discussed the Clothesline Project and the upcoming Women's Equality Day. At 10:30, Per Fogering speaks with Ivan Elland, senior fellow at the Independent Institute. He wrote a recent piece titled 9/11 Commission Chairman Admit Whitewashing the Cause of the Attacks. And at 11, Democracy Now! Rumi said, "Beyond ideas, there is a field. I will meet you there."
KBOO's annual used book and record sale will be Saturday, August 26th from 9 to 4 at the Musicians Union Hall, located at 325 Northeast 20th. There will be fabulous books, CDs, and vinyl, and madcap fun. Profits from the sale benefit KBOO. Again, that's Saturday, August 26th from 9 to 4 at the Musicians Union Hall, located at 325 Northeast 20th. For more information, call Ani Haynes at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
I'm George Takei. Exclusion and resistance on Crossing East.
Angel Island was known at the time as the guardian of the Western Gate.
One year they say you're white, but not Caucasian, and the next year they say you're Caucasian, but not white.
And it was clear that America was telling the immigrants that we don't care about you and that we blame you for our wealth or ills.
Crossing East on this radio station.
That's next Tuesday at 10 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.